First Baptist Church of Redmond, February 9th, 2014. Scars.
Today we'll be reading Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of teasing. It is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Thank you. You may be seated.
Thank you very much. This is the way I was looking at these passages today. I've titled our message, Scars. Because that's what this is talking about today, is scars, and I don't have very far to go except to look at my right hand. I don't know about you, I use my right hand for most everything. When I look at my right hand, I have lessons that I have learned. When I was 17 years old, I started working part-time at a scrap company. I talk about it a lot. And one of my first jobs was, the joke is, you're a pilot, but I'm bummed. Because you're pilot here, pilot here, pilot here. They would have truckloads of stuff come in, and, you know, 17 years old, you don't know nothing. Sorry, not you guys are different, okay? I appreciate it. You guys are smarter. But 17 years old, you don't know nothing. So my job was to put things in different places. Put it here, put it there, put it this, put it that. And so the company serviced different businesses and would take their scrap. One of the businesses we served was a meatpacking company. And so there was a large barrel that we would get, well, barrels we would get from them. But one of the things they did is they would cut meat. And they cut meat with a bandsaw. You know, it's the big kind of thing. Continuous blade, moving along, sharp teeth. And so I'm new at this job. What do I do? He says, oh, just put some gloves on. You'll be fine. So I grabbed my leather gloves. I got me a nice pair of gloves. I went over there, and we had these barrels that had these bandsaw blades, which were too dull for the job, but they were still meat saw bandsaw blades. So I remember almost my first moment, I reached in there. I grabbed this big thing because I was going to pull it out and put it in a pile, and I pulled up, but the bandsaw did not move. And on the inside of, I'm going to go this way first. Sorry, wrong illustration. But I cut my finger almost off. The pinky on my right hand. I won't give too many details because maybe it bothers you. But I have a scar there. I have a scar there on the inside of my hand that says you can prepare all you want, but still, danger could happen. Now let's go back to the first one. Then I started off with the wrong one. My parents were getting ready to move from their house into a senior's high-rise where they lived until they passed away. And so I was living in Iowa, and I was going to go back and help my parents move. I was married then. It's a good thing I was married, because if I wasn't married, I'd probably be dead now. Here's what I mean. I hated to wear a seatbelt. As a matter of fact, it was one of the things I've disciplined. I only wear a seatbelt because God tells you to, because you're supposed to obey the government. The government says wear your seatbelt. Okay, I'll wear my seatbelt. So I was going to go home and help my parents move, but I'd been to school, and I'd been to work. I worked all night, and it was time to go, so I thought, you know what, I can handle it. I can hop in the car, and I can drive 10 hours to Denver, no big deal after working all night. I don't need any sleep. Drove, got about 7-8 hours along the way. I was tired. I pulled over. I slept for an hour. Got back in the car, drove, and I saw a mile, so I'm 30 miles outside of Denver, and then you know the story. I fell asleep driving. I woke up when I was just starting to swerve, and I thought, oh no, I'm swerving, and I overcorrected, and I went into, you know, I-76 was this way, and the other was this way, and in the middle is a grass median that goes low, and I went in, and as soon as the car started rolling over, I hit my head on the roof, but I had my seatbelt on, because I had the windows down. So I had the seatbelt on, and because I had the seatbelt on, even though I rolled on the driver's side, and the policeman who came in the emergency room told me that if I would not have had my seatbelt on, I would have been ejected and the car would have rolled on me. And God, you'd be at somebody else's church today. Because I had my seatbelt on, God saved my life, and I just hit my head. But I had this scar on my finger that reminds me not to overestimate my abilities. So you got to sleep once in a while. So, the point of those two stories, from that one and then from this one, is that you can learn lasting lessons at bad times. That is going to be the message of Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 1 through 6 today as we look at this passage, because the scars that form on our lives are oftentimes much better teaching points than the fun times that we receive. In our book, up until this point, Solomon has been doing a lot of complaining. He talks about the misery of living under the sun. He talks about someone who has started his life out well, doing what God said, following his edicts, and blessing with wisdom, riches, power, and strength. And then he had too many fans. Because his friend said, you know, Solomon, you could really try this just once. Just try this once. I know that God's blessed with wisdom and knowledge, and you don't do this kind of stuff, and you're honoring him. But you ought to just try it once, so you'll know what you're talking about. You'll just know what it's like if you just do it once and then quit. And then Solomon started to listen to him, it seems, because in the middle part of his life, the first six chapters talks about, you know, I tried everything. I experienced everything that there was. So imagine the similar case that we have today. We would have had the same opportunities to, if you will, sin in the same way. He tried it all. And now, as he's near the end of his life, he's writing these things down and talking about his frustration so he can pass on some wisdom. The first six chapters, as we said, there are a lot of complaining, remarking. And now he changes his tone. If you look in your Bible, it might even have a slightly different way that your Bible lists the verses. Because the greatest part of his life was spent when he was writing the book of Proverbs. That seems to be early in his life and in his ministry as king. And he's changing back now from a complaining wisdom style to a proverbial wisdom style. So in chapter 7 through 10, he is now not so much dwelling on, this is terrible, frustrating, and it didn't give me what I was expecting. Sin was not as fun the next day. Now he wakes up, if you will, and he changes his tone to talk about the lessons that he has learned. Here is the wisdom as he reflects. What should I have done? What should I have been learning? In this first section of chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, again, he changes his tone to a proverb style, like the book of Proverbs, where he will have comments like, as, he will make contrasts, comparisons, explanations, as he's using pithy style. Some of these things would rhyme in the original language, they don't rhyme in English, but he's giving you a style of wisdom where he's trying to demonstrate that his mind is not totally gone. When I was younger, he would say to himself, I was wise, everyone came to me, and he's trying to go back to that way of communication now. And he was on top, pleasing God. So I think he's now trying to say, you've listened to me babble about the foolishness of my life as I've tried to live like everybody else, but to the nth degree. So now he says, let's stop for a minute. Let's adjust our thinking. Let me tell you as best I can the lessons that God would have us to learn from my wasted years of life so that you will see this and you will get the grip. And since, I believe, Solomon is looking back at his life with frustration, disappointment, perhaps some anger, definitely looking at the waste of time, the things he wasted, the money, the time, and the years that he wasted. He says, I live foolishly, and I don't want you, he says in these verses, to live foolishly, wasting time and energy on the wrong kinds of things. You need to live your life with some gravity, gravitas. You need to live life with some seriousness. Because if there's anything that characterized me as a young adult, he says, I was not serious. I wasted time, wasted energy. And he says, if you want to, as I have up here, face the facts, he says, bad times and the scars that they leave with us teach us more than all the good times we will experience. So if you've had a party, had time with your friends, told a lot of jokes, and told a lot of stories, but a week later, remember the joke they told? No, I don't remember, but it broke everybody up. Yeah, yeah. Remember the game they played? Yeah, yeah. I remember who played, but boy, we had a good time, didn't we? Yeah. So you just have this nebulous memory. Yeah, it was kind of fun, but I remember anything. I didn't remember anything. Let me try that again. He says, instead, consider suffering. Because when you are suffering, when your friends are suffering, you suddenly learn what is important. This week, a quote-unquote Facebook friend, somebody I went to high school with all those eons ago, a year younger than myself, she was in graduating class after I was, commented that in the house this last week, I think it was just right away on Monday, she heard a noise, a thud. And she went around the corner, and her husband, about our age, fell over dead. No idea, no whatever, just he was dead. The funeral was Friday. And she's commenting on, now starts the next phase in my life. Now is, and so she's reaching and is experiencing all these things we are talking about. Because she has, if you will, her postings that were before about animals and she likes Native American culture and things like that, now they've all been about the seriousness of life and facing changes and how there's really no way to prepare for things, even though you may think about them. So she is going through this where she is learning some of the most instructive things that life can offer. And she's passing them on to some of her friends. And as Solomon does this, he says, listen, if you really want to have some value, don't go to a party, don't go to a wedding, go to a funeral. He says, there's lessons you can learn at a funeral that will change your life, that you will consider things that you have never considered before. As we said, we don't learn much at parties except the latest gossip or how much you can do something. But funerals put us in the front row to life's ultimate questions. Realism, things you're going to face. What are you going to do now? What are you going to do about this now? Somebody else might have taken care of this for you. Now, you are taking care of this. What will you do? Where will you go? Who do you talk to? How do you turn yourself? How do you fix it? Where do you tap to get this to work? There's nobody to call and ask. What will you do? Let's see what's happening. And as it starts off in our passage, he talks to us about having a name. I'm reading the first verse. A good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death than the day of one's birth. I'll read the second verse also. Better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. If you come to church tonight, you're going to see this very verse again. Nehemiah 9:10, because I'm going to talk about this. It talks about a good name. Because what he's saying is, when all things are over, what do you think of someone? Now, look at that person. If you look at sports right now, there's all this evaluation of athletes. There's a man who's a much more incredible athlete than I am, who's in the news, Bodie, or heard him, he's been to the Olympics. In the tryouts, he had the number one time in two out of the three tryout races before the Olympics. And he's a sure thing to win. The question is, will anybody give him opposition? So if you saw the results, if you didn't, you know, turn your ear off right now, but in the Olympic downhill alpine, he finished 0.5 seconds behind the fastest skier. What does that mean? For him, that's earth-shattering, because times are separated by hundreds of seconds, and being a half a second slower than the fastest skier, he doesn't get any medal. No results for that race. Shock. Amazement. He said, I can't believe that Bodie Miller didn't win this by a huge margin. And they're talking about what he did wrong. And he said, it's a half a second. There's other races he's going to enter, but it's a half a second. And he feels like his life is destroyed. Why? His reputation precedes him. We look here about a good name. When we think in the Old Testament way of thinking, our Jewish way of thinking, when you talk about the word name, it's more than a label. What is your name? Doug, what is your name?
Daniel. What is your info in your bank? When you think of name, when they ask what is his name, they're not asking who he is. They're asking what is he like? What thoughts, what actions show what he is? It talks about reputation that flows from character. When he talks about going to a funeral, the value you learn from there is that death makes us think about life. Like a party for its own sake, a funeral makes you think about it. What is he like? What has he done? What are the good things that you can realistically say about someone? And I want to point out Nehemiah 9:10, because we're going to look at this tonight when we look at the book of Exodus. So forgive me, if you're looking for this, if you look in the Old Testament, remember? God appears to Moses in a burning bush. And God tells him to take his shoes off. He's on holy ground. And Moses is talking to God. He says, God, what is your name that I can tell the people that when you say you're going to deliver them from Egypt, because they've been complaining in Egypt for hundreds of years about being in slavery, God, what is your name that I can tell them who sent me? He's not asking them for God's name. They knew God as Jehovah. They knew God as the great deliverer, El Gabor, the mighty one. What Moses is asking is, God, you've let those people go down to Egypt, and they've been crying for your deliverance for a couple hundred years now. They just are off in slavery, but they're now. And God, you've left them there enslaved. You didn't deliver them right away. You didn't crush those Egyptians when the Hyksos came in. You didn't crush the people who came up after them. God, what is it about you and your freedom for your people that I can tell them about so that when I say I'm coming in your name, the deliverer, what is it about you that's going to make them realize, ah, God is a deliverer? Because to them, God is the one who brought them to Egypt and left them there, and they were in servitude. Nehemiah 9:10, you sent miraculous signs against Pharaoh. You divided the sea before the Israelites, so they passed through on dry ground. You led them with a pillar of cloud, and by night with a pillar of fire to give the light on the way they were to take. This is how God displayed his name to the Israelites, that he was a deliverer, that the amazing, and the Bible calls them wonders more than it does plagues, the amazing wonders that God did show that he is powerful and can act. So when it talks about here, reflecting on life, reflecting on the name, he says, if you go to a funeral, you're going to find what people are really like. You're going to find what their character is because of it was displayed in their actions. So it says, people, if you think you're getting away with something, you're not getting away with anything. People know what you're like. People know what you do. And anything else is just your own self-deception. Verses 4 through 5, he says, sorrow is better than laughter. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the hearts of fools is the house of mirth. It's better to rebuke of the wise than for men to be clapping the song of fools. He says, laughter is quickly forgotten. Jokes, you know, Jay Leno finally retired. Jokes are empty. What do they last? But looking around, making a trip to Arlington National Cemetery can change your life. When you look at the investment of human life, energy, activity, what did someone did? What did they get a medal for? What is going on? Sorrow is better than laughter, he says. Because when we think of the cost that is invested in life's experiences, you begin to see what really has value. Verses 5 and 6, it is better, it's at the beginning of verse 5, to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. I won't talk about the Grammys today. God just did. Okay. But most of us fail to listen to the valuable, corrective words that we hear. When you look up there, I feel sorry for the people that came looking at my basketball game on Friday. Let me illustrate. Bless their hearts, I have a little group of 10 basketball girls. Our season's over on Tuesday. And There's always tragedy when someone tells you, oh, Doug, I scheduled you with an easy team on Friday. You will have no trouble. Well, at the school I coach at, they just had a play, a big play, and almost every one of my players was in that play either on Wednesday or Thursday. And it's kind of cold and stuff, and they're memorizing, and guess what? I show up to my activity on Friday, and out of my 10, I only have 6. Because everybody else is sick and tired from the play, and they can't come. So suddenly I have 6 little tiny children going to go against, I quit counting the other team after 12, and we're going to run really hard. Well, bless our hearts, we call time out, we talk about things, do this, do that. Yes, coach, I'm really tired. So we talk about something, they go out, and they don't remember a thing. Guess what? You just shrug your shoulders and say, raw, and go do your best. So if I'm looking at the parents are looking at me, and I said, I apologize, parents, for not preparing and equipping your children better than I have. And they just looked at me with this nodding expression, and some of them said, yeah, they don't listen to this at home either. Life goes on. You can do better. But that's the point. When we hear corrective words, second bottom paragraph, we either do one of two things. We either cringe with too much rejection, like Bodie Miller, oh, how terrible it was, that's half a second slow, I shouldn't even try. Or if someone gives you a good piece of advice, sometimes you think, well, yeah, I'm going to do it differently. Thanks for telling me. I know you've done it before, but you don't know what I do. So we so often don't listen and remember to the good advice that we are given. And when God looks at what we think and do, look at that. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot. Try something you're good at doing when the scout time is when the kid who goes out and lights the fire. Sometimes we've had fire circle out there. Craig goes out, all the boys can do it, but Craig, he goes out and he gets these little tiny sticks and he lines them up in like a little full looking log house and sits them up and like the little things on fire. And pretty soon we go up and get the big things on fire. That's what you do, Mr. Norman, right? Have the little tiny twigs and then you get slightly bigger twigs and then the really big logs work. The little tiny twigs, how long do they burn? Can I cook a hot dog over my little tiny twig? Can I melt a s'more over my little tiny twig? I need a bunch of little tiny twigs just to get the next tiny twig to burn, don't I? So when God says, like the crackling of thorns, little tiny twigs, under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. When God looks at us and says, I don't want to worry about those things, God. I'm having too much fun. I'm worried about myself. I want to go just our way. God says, that's just like more brush on the fire. Your words to me are like vapor, smoke, because it'll last from one moment to the next. So for us, Solomon is talking to us about wisdom, and after complaining, he stops complaining and says, you got to get serious. I was not serious. I played around with God. I joked around with God. God gave me a lot of gifts. I wasted them. Listen, most of you aren't king. You're not going to be able to start over like I am. You got to get it right first. So I think this is what Solomon is saying. Is wisdom guarding us from extremes? He took his opportunities and he lived to the extremes that were wasteful. He says, don't waste. Don't be too sleepy either. He says, do what you know to do that's right. It's wisdom keeping us stable. Because sometimes hearing both criticism and praise can require inner strength. You have to be strong enough to let people tell you to do something different. And sometimes hearing praise, so you don't hear anything else. As when I was Solomon, he heard enough praise that he didn't listen to anything else. And then his wisdom clearing our minds, reaching us to a level of discernment. God, help me be able to use your words and your truth so I can know just what to do. I love this story. If you're curious, this is right off of BBC News. I want to tell you about a gentleman named Jade Hansen. This is a story a few years old. I looked at this and, oh, this is perfect. He has an act that in the past was with a traveling circus that was mostly in Great Britain, the Cottle and Austin Circus. I don't know if that's famous or not. Is that famous? Has anyone heard it before? The Cottle and Austin Circus. That's where he worked. And you can see, can you tell what he's holding? What is he holding? Can you tell? Might not be clear in the picture. It is a knife. What do you think that is? He's a knife thrower. And the circus had been trying for a year to recruit someone for the position of standing and having the knife thrown at them. So it's reached a BBC news source because, well, they haven't been able to hire a full-time person to stand there, and it pays £240 a week, plus the benefits, travel with the circus, stay in a hotel if we do there. To stand there and let this gentleman, Jade Hansen, throw knives at you. So the picture of the lady there is Polly Cottle. Who is she? She is quitting as his assistant. See, she was never hired as his assistant because his previous assistant, after a while, and having the knives were too quick. And they put five by, so they looked at her, and she is a trapeze artist and had a job at the circus. And they said, you know, can you just come over and throw knives at you today? Okay, we'll worry about it tomorrow. The next day, oh, Polly, can you come over and let Jade throw knives at you and speak for today? So after a year of that, she resigned and left to join another circus because she got tired and they wouldn't let her out of it. I was the only person available, she says, to take the role. It was always a temporary arrangement. Twice a day, 6 days a week for several months, she's taken the spotlight to face a salvo of knives hurling at her at 60 miles an hour. She says, to stick to that job for that long, you need a lot of faith in your partner. If I didn't trust him, I wouldn't do it. He's very good, very skilled. It only takes a few minutes, and the knife thrower's assistant job description has to be short. But she says that she must admit to having been, and she uses the word stung, a few times on the arms and shoulders. Ouch. If you step sideways or even just move your head, it'll put him off, and you could end up taking a knife. Why are we looking at this? We are facing life. And sometimes in life, you move along and you feel like life is throwing knives at you. And how can I get out of the way? And sometimes the only way to handle life is to stand exactly where God has you. With your arms and your head and your understanding, exactly God says, go here. This is the way you walk in, so I move away. And knives are going everywhere. Thunk, 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 thunk. And you think, maybe if I try something else, maybe if I move over here, I won't be so nervous. But the knife thrower is going to throw where he throws, and then you better not be there. Like the lady said, she wouldn't have done it at all, but she trusted him. And because she trusted him, she could do it for a year. But after a year of that, she's done. She's going to quit. I can't stand this anymore. For us, sometimes God has a limited place where he wants us to be. Narrow is the way, he says. Stand in the way. Be there. Be on the narrow path. Because the knives are going everywhere else. Don't go where the knives are. Stay on the narrow path. Is it hard to get on the narrow path? Yes. Do you have anxiety being on the narrow path? Yes. Is it fearful sometimes being on the narrow path? Yes. And if you don't get on the narrow path, you have a lot more room until the knife comes. Solomon is telling you, I've seen a lot of knives. And unfortunately, he says, I was off the narrow path and I took a few. He says, you better stay on that narrow path. Trust God. Do what he says. He says, I've been at meetings where people who walked off the path got some scars. And they'll tell you to stay on the path. He says, you're better off being a disciple and stay where you should be than being an example by showing people your scars and where you didn't do what you should have done. Let's pray.
God, help us to honor you with the things that we do. Help us to see that you give us your guidance, your rules, your instructions, your plans for a reason, and help us to stay on that narrow path that your disciples should follow. That's us. Father, help us to make certain of our calling and election, make sure that we're in your family. And Father, as we step onto this next path of obedience, that we honor you, your son's death. That his son's death is what draws us together and gives us the riches, the blessings, the mercy, the grace, and the promise of a home in heaven. Help us to be respectful and to realize that, yes, God, this is the only way to meet you is through your son. In his mighty name we pray, and everyone said,